title of this session, I've taken the title for each session from a different category of psalms. I think it'll become clear what those titles mean as we enter into each session, but they give some title of the they give some indication of the direction of each session. Today, the title of the session is His Steadfast Love Endures Forever. Tomorrow, it will be Hear My Cry, O Lord. Wednesday, O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is thy name, and Thursday, lift up your head, O Lord. Now there are 150 psalms. Needless to say, we are not going to study all 150 psalms in 4 days. That would be about 38 psalms a day, only to take Psalm 1. Okay, we'll take a quick look at that and go on to Psalm 2. what I want to do today is give us a brief overview of the psalms, but spend a large amount of our time today laying out for you a structure of Israel's faith understanding that is seen through the Psalms, a pattern out of which we can understand Israel's faith as she brought that faith to expression in her worship. And then to look at the end of today's session at what I call salvation history psalms, which present a kind of a confessional overview of Israel's faith out of that pattern. Then each of the subsequent three sessions will deal with one segment of that pattern that we lay out today. And we'll look at some examples of each of types of psalms that illustrate those segments of the pattern each day. Probably we'll only be able to look at maybe 20 or so psalms as representative of different types during 4 days. But they were, within that structure, they will illustrate the vast majority of psalms that appear in the Psalter. Now, the title for the Book of Psalms comes from the Greek word psalmos, which means music of stringed instruments. But the Hebrew title is really closer to giving us something of the nature of the book. The Hebrew title for the book was Tehillim, which means songs of praise. Now, it is not technically true that all of the psalms in the Psalter are psalms or hymns of praise. But it is true that praise is such a basic category that it can be used in the Hebrew understanding of worship to describe even psalms as seemingly distant from praise as a lament, a cry for help, a plea in time of trouble. Even those psalms, as we will see, are encompassed in the Hebrew notion of praise, which is extremely basic and fundamental. So there's a sense in which, because all of these psalms, even the psalms of lament, serve the purpose of extolling and glorifying God, that it is not too inaccurate to call the whole of the Psalter by the title Songs of Praise. Even the lament move toward praise. I want right at the beginning to put to rest the notion that the Psalms are a book of individualized devotion material. Of course, it is possible to use the Psalms in one's personal devotional life, but this is not the setting out of which they originated. The Psalms have not been as well understood theologically as they might have been because they've been horribly sentimentalized. The setting is not the lonely shepherd poet on the hill. If the Psalms came from the lonely shepherd poet on the hill, then they would be evidence only of the faith experience of some lonely shepherd poet on a hill. And then I would say, I'm not a lonely shepherd poet on a hill, so why should I pay any attention to this material? The Psalms are the literature of the Israelite worshiping community. They are a varied type from vastly different periods of time. They range all across the time expanse of Israel's historic experience. but they all root in Israel's experience of coming together as a corporate community to reflect on and share the faith understanding which emerged out of that experience. And as such, they are witness to the faith of a whole people. And they are as diverse in terms of pointing to experience within that corporate community. They are as diverse as human experience itself. Therefore, the Psalms are not simply the individual witness of the individual poet, but the distilled corporate witness of a whole people brought into its final form as the product of reflection over a whole expanse of generations to be a witness, to be a living witness to those who make use of the Psalter in subsequent generations of the worshiping community. This is a vastly different understanding of Psalms than most have possessed of them, and unlocks their riches in a way I hope we will find illuminating in these next 4 days. The process by, I'll spend a bit of time here on just a few introductory details about the Book of Psalms and the way in which it's organized. The process by which the present book was formed started with the formation of small collections of psalms in the early periods of Israel's life as a nation in the land. None of the psalms extend back earlier than the period of kingship, because there was not the organized liturgical life that we have, particularly after the building of Solomon's temple. But the beginning of the Psalter were the smaller collections of psalms, and the superscriptions of the psalms, which we'll look at in a moment, give us a clue to this. You'll notice some of the psalms say at the beginning a psalm of David or a psalm of Asaph, different groupings there. The earliest collections may have been put together during or just following the reign of David, probably during the very earliest days of the Temple of Solomon. Other small collections were created under later kings and guilds of musicians, which were attached to the temple and came to have great influence. And some of the small collections are labeled as the collections of some of these guilds. For instance, the Psalms of the Sons of Korah. There are little collections of psalms with that title at the beginning. Or the Psalms of Asaph. Well, Korah and Asaph are both names that are known to us from the Book of Chronicles as the heads of guilds of temple singers. So these are the collections which were brought together, probably under their patronage. Those which say Psalms of David do not mean that David wrote all of those psalms. David also, in the Book of Chronicles, is credited with founding the earliest guilds of temple singers, the earliest guilds of musicians, which later then, with the building of the temple, were attached to Solomon's temple. So a psalm of David does not mean written by David, but perhaps part of a collection under the sponsorship of the Davidic guild. The little Hebrew preposition there could mean of, by, for, to, with, any of those things. So it does not mean authorship so much as it means a tradition of temple singing, a tradition of liturgical life that traces its roots back to David. The collections were, the smaller collections then were edited together into larger collections, and you can see the evidences of this at some places in the Book of Psalms. And during or just after the Babylonian exile, around 587 BC, these collections were brought together into a single large collection, pretty much as we have it now. And it was then that the Psalms were put into their present order and divided into five books. You'll notice if you have an RSV that right before Psalm 1, there's a big title that says Book 1. Well, there are five, the Psalter is divided into five books, meant probably to correspond to the five books of the Law of Moses. And And just as worship life during the exile began to develop the notion that the Torah also came to fixed form during this period, just as one in the life of the synagogue was to read through the Torah on a regular schedule every year, probably the Psalter was divided into segments that corresponded to these readings of the Torah. And you can see these divisions in the five books scattered throughout the Psalter. Psalm 1 is something of a prologue to the entire collection, and Psalm 150 is a sort of a doxology concluding the book. But lest you think that the number is fixed at 150, you should be aware that different traditions have differing numbers and divisions. The Douay version of the Bible, which was the official Roman Catholic version for many years, numbers the Psalms somewhat differently, still coming out with 150, but combining some Psalms under one number and dividing others in half, so that which psalm has which number as you go through doesn't always remain the same. So that can be confusing sometimes if you're ever in a study group and using different translations. The Dead Sea Scrolls contained a scroll of the Book of Psalms, which had, lo and behold, 151 psalms, and the 151st was one we had never known before. So probably when some of the newest translations have included the 151st Psalm as a kind of an appendix to the Book of Psalms, and you may get a chance to see that some. I don't think it's in any of the Bibles we have around here. I want to say one further word about the superscription. The superscriptions are those little words of instruction and explanation that come before the psalm. Not every psalm has a superscription, but many of them do. They were probably added at a very late stage by the editor. They were not part of the psalms as they were developed in liturgical life, but probably has something to do with the way they were edited together for use in worship. And they sometimes give us the literary type of the psalm, for instance, a prayer, a poem, a migdal, whatever that, or a miktam, whatever that is. There are some words that we just don't know how to translate there. They sometimes give instructions for rendering it liturgically or musically, for instance, on eight strings, or for the flute, or for the memorial offering, or in the upper choir. The New English Bible, which appeared some years ago, I think, in my mind, committed an abominable heresy by leaving out all of the superscription. I think that was really unfortunate. They are a part of the Psalter, even if we don't always know what all of those instructions mean. To me, they're kind of signposts that these are out of the liturgical life, the gathered corporate witness of the community. By seeing all those little instructional notes, I think we're reminded that we're dealing with the witness of a corporate experience as it was formalized in worship. Some of the superscriptions are just fun to try to guess at what in the world they might ever have meant. Translators, you have to understand, are usually an audacious lot. Even if they don't understand what it means, they translate it. And so you find superscriptions in there that say things like, according to dove on far-off terebinth. According to dove on far-off terebinth. Nobody knows what that could possibly mean. But the translator and those who study Hebrew language knew all of the words, and so they translated it, but put together those words don't seem to mean anything. My own theory is that that's the Hebrew equivalent of "to the tune of my darling Clementine." Dove on far off terebinth was a well-known drinking song.
but
there are lots of them like that, and they're kind of fun. There's according to Hind of the Dawn, and whatever that means. According to Lilies, there are three psalms in a group, Psalm 57 to 59, that say, "According to Do Not Destroy." And I think those are psalms that there was a scribe, you know, copying the psalms, and he got interrupted for lunch, and he left a little note there: "Do not destroy." Then he had a stroke while he was at lunch, and someone else came back to finish his work and said, "Oh well, according to Do Not Destroy," and then wrote the psalm. Occasionally, the superscriptions give historical information, especially from the life of David, because certain of these psalms were associated with the life of David. So the great penitential psalm, Psalm 51, very appropriately says to the choir master, a psalm of David, when Nathan the prophet came to him after he had gone into Bathsheba. Well, that's certainly a moment in the life of David we'd want to remember related to this great psalm of penitence. Well, with those introductory remarks, I want to turn to the heart of the matter here and talk about the central faith understanding which seems to show through the Psalms, and try to show us an overview of that, of the structure of that faith understanding, and then use Psalms in these subsequent days to illustrate in greater detail the parts of that. Israel borrowed many forms of speech and literature from her neighbors, and the Psalms are no exception. After all, Israel had no experience with developed temple worship and all of its trappings. So the tendency for form was to borrow from her neighbors, and in formal type, the Psalms are very much like the kinds of hymns and prayers that we find surviving in other ancient Near Eastern literature. But the faith understanding, which forms the content of those Psalms, is where the difference and the uniqueness of Israel's Psalter begins to show through. The ancient Near Eastern cultures, for the most part, found the gods in the powers of nature. Nature was alive with divinities. In the Canaanite pantheon, which was the most immediate culture interacting with Israel, there was Baal, who was the great storm god, the god who brought the rain. The various goddesses with which Baal was associated were usually earth goddesses associated with the fertility of the earth. There were gods of the sun and the moon and the stars, gods of the great natural elements like the sea, gods of those mysterious forces like death, which invaded all of human experience. And the Canaanite worshiper then saw himself in the midst of a whole seething drama of divine interaction between these various gods. Baal fought with the god of the sea, who represented chaos, in order to bring order. Baal fought and was vanquished by the god death, only to rise again, and this symbolized the dying and the winter and the rising again of the new life in the spring. The worshiper felt somewhat at the mercy of this. It was sort of like standing in the middle of a stage while the play was going on around you. You needed protection from that. And so the priesthood and worship in Canaanite religion, and in fact in most ancient of the ancient Near Eastern religions that we know, was designed to manipulate, appease, and control these gods, either to gain their favor or to at least gain protection from them. So different cities had patron gods that were to be their protection against the whims of this divine drama that was playing itself out. And the powers of nature, the divinity of the gods who inhabited the powers of nature operated quite independently of the human sphere. And in fact, some of the worship life of the Canaanites was designed simply to keep from coming to the attention of God. Now, the Hebrew understanding of the divine realm was radically different than this. First of all, you don't have a pantheon of gods and goddesses. You have the one God who is the creator of all that is. But this God not only did not operate independently of the human sphere, this God chose primarily to be known in interaction with the human sphere. This God was also known in nature, because God was the creator of nature. But one in the Hebrew faith, one came to know God primarily because God, out of God's own initiative, had chosen to involve himself in the human and to involve himself in a way that indicated the care of God for humanity. This was part of the fundamental foundations out of which Israel came to being as a people in the first place. So far from feeling at the mercy of the gods, at the whim of the gods, or feeling that one needed protection from getting in the path of the gods, in the Hebrew experience, God became one because of this interaction with the human experience that one could count on for help in times of trouble. God was known not above or beyond, but within the common struggles of life, past, present, and future. An encounter with God for the Hebrews always began with reflection on Israel's own experience. Because of her historic experience with God, she came to know something of how God was present in the midst. There's a struggle with the powers of nature going on outside. I'm sure they feel that way someday. If you see some of those stones they're chopping out of the ground out there. Now, the encounter with God in history affected in the past, and the memory of Israel of those past encounters demonstrated something to her of how encounter with God continued to take place in the present. And that fell into a kind of a pattern for Israel of distress and deliverance. Now, the primary experience, the sort of paradigm experience for this, was the Exodus experience, because that was the formative experience out of which Israel came to birth as a people. You'll find over and over again, not only in the Psalms, but elsewhere in the Old Testament, when Israel wants to sort of set forth a credo, a creed, a recital of her faith, that Exodus experience looms as the central experience. You can look at places like Deuteronomy 26 and Joshua 24, where you have great recitations of the great events in which God has involved himself with human history. And the pattern of those experiences is that distress, because of God's intervention, becomes deliverance. Israel was in bondage in Egypt, in a situation of distress from which she was incapable of delivering herself. Her only hope was a God who cared enough to become directly involved, a God who says to Moses at the burning bush, "I have heard the cry, I have seen the sufferings of my people, their cry has come to me, I know their sufferings." And to know in Hebrew almost has the sense of to experience. It's not just head knowledge. But to know someone, or to know in Hebrew, is almost to experience it. This is a God who, as the Old Testament goes on, increasingly is revealed as a God who not only knows and cares about the suffering of his human creation, but experiences it and suffers, experiences that suffering with it. A God who suffers, ultimately the greatest expression of that in our faith is the Word become flesh and the crucifixion. So that out of this experience of distress, a seemingly hopeless situation becoming a situation of new life because God had chosen to involve himself, there came an understanding that God was not remote, operating independently off there in the powers of nature, but with us and constantly in tune to our struggles, but also our joys, our sorrows and our celebrations. This meant that even those moments when there seemed to be no future, that God opens a way into the future. Hopelessness becomes hope. Lamentation, to use the language of Psalms, lamentation always moves to praise. We're going to see that when we look at the Psalms of Lament. And therefore, for the Hebrew, because God is known to be involved and caring of all that happens in the human experience, therefore praise is appropriate to all moments of life. Not to be able to praise, even in moments of crisis, is to be without hope. Now the Psalms are the distilled evidence of the response of Israel as a worshiping community to this historical encounter with God. If you've had a formative experience of God's presence, if the community does not somehow celebrate that, hold it forth, put it into symbolic witness, then the subsequent generations may forget about that experience with God. So there's a sense in which liturgy becomes memory here. It's the memory of the community that they have known a God that is known in this way, in encounter with the experience of his people. I want to schematize this pattern that we've been talking about and its theological content in the following way. And I'll make a kind of a chart on the board here. The board's kind of small. There are going to be four columns here, so we'll have to write a little small to get it all on. The pattern goes like this. In all human experience, there are situations of distress. So distress is the beginning point for understanding this pattern. Exodus, as I have said, was the sort of central paradigm for this, the distress which becomes a kind of a pattern for all subsequent experiences of human distress. The Hebrews well understood that Exodus did not mean only a memory that had to do with those moments when you might find yourself as slaves in Egypt, but became a paradigm for all of those moments in which one seems to be in distress with no way apparent into the future. Those moments of hopelessness that we all experience both corporately and individually. So Exodus becomes a paradigm for all of those moments of human experience from which we are incapable of extricating ourselves, in which we need to turn to the Lord. It was Israel's experience from Exodus onward, and she kept seeing this Exodus pattern recur in her experience, that the God that Israel worshiped was one made known in those situations of distress by means of unexpected deliverance. I put the adjective unexpected there because the way into the future from a moment of distress, from a time of trouble, was not always the way into the future that Israel, either individual or corporate Israel, expected. Certainly that was true even at Exodus.
with the sea in front and the Egyptian army bearing down behind, it seemed like a hopeless and lost situation. There seemed to be no possibilities in this situation. And suddenly, lo and behold, new possibilities arise in a totally unexpected way. Who would have expected a path through the sea? Well, that became, again, a kind of a paradigm for the way in which God's deliverance operates. Deliverance was not always simply the granting of the wishes for the person in distress who cries out of the depths. But it was the expression of this theme in the Psalms is the constant assurance, trust, and confidence that a way into the future will be possible for those who trust in the Lord. That there are no moments from which there are no possibilities for new life. There are no moments, no matter how distressful, how seemingly hopeless, from which there are no possibilities for the future with God. But the pattern that future takes is often very unexpected. Last week we were studying 2 Isaiah, and here were the Israelites in exile in Babylon in a completely despairing and hopeless situation. And the prophet comes along and says, the way of salvation which the Lord is working in your midst is Cyrus, this pagan Persian king, who's going to be the instrument of God's salvation. Well, that was about as unexpected a path of salvation as you could imagine. What happens is that Israel, having known this pattern over and over again in her experience and attempting to understand that pattern in her own ongoing presence, then is led to respond in community. Israel is called to be the community which, having known the deliverance which comes in times of distress, having known that experience in her past, then witnesses to that experience as the corporate community in every subsequent present. And that witness takes two forms. It takes the form of worship, of which the Psalms are the primary evidence. Worship becomes the formal remembrance of that pattern and the formal remembrance of the God who acts like this. In symbolic occasions, both of petition and of celebration. But it also spells itself out in terms of ethics. The community which knows itself to be a delivered community is called upon to live differently. That's what I mean by ethics, the way of, in a sense, this has to do with a different understanding of being and a different understanding of doing. The delivered community is going to self-consciously identify itself in a different way, and it's going to act in a different way. Now, the Psalms show us more of that worship experience than it does of the ethical life. We would have to look at the themes of covenant and law, I think, to see some of and the prophetic literature to see a lot of the implications in the ethical realm. But that is not absent in the Psalms. And in our last session, I'm going to point to some Psalms where Israel in its liturgical life is also reminded that as a delivered community, she's called upon to act differently toward the neighbor, toward those other individuals in the community who are in distress, as those not only for whom God cares, but whom the community is called to especially care for. We'll see that witness in the Psalms as well. Now, I've been trying to use language for this pattern that are most characteristic of the language used in the Psalms themselves, but let me try to translate this a bit to show you that this is not a pattern which is just some archaic Israelite understanding, this is a pattern of which we are the heirs. We are still the direct descendants of this, of the faith understanding that shows itself forth in the Psalms. When we talk about situations of distress, we are talking about what we have often spoken of theologically throughout history as the human situation. The human situation, as it is described in the faith tradition, the human situation is one which understands that human beings are not self-sufficient creatures, that we come into moments of distress from which we are not, for which we do not have the resources within ourselves, that we are in need of the mediated grace which comes from God. That's the witness of the faith tradition, that the human situation is one which is broken. So that what we're really talking about here is what classically we refer to in the doctrine of sin, that we are sinful, broken creatures, that our experience as human beings is not shalom, which is the Hebrew word meaning whole. It is only God who can restore shalom. We are called, and it's God who calls us to live in the community of shalom, but we would not be capable of living as that community without the new possibilities announced to us through God's intervention in our history. In the midst of the human situation, the witness of faith is that new possibilities or new life is made available, not from within our own resources, but from God. It's the witness of faith that it is God's action in history that has given us the capability of receiving new life, the possibility of receiving new life. This is spoken of in classical terms as grace. And then the response of the community which hears that word of new possibility and new life in the midst of the human situation then lives as a changed community. It's a different kind of community than it would be if it was reliant only on the understandings which come from the world and from our own human resources. This, of course, speaks to what we have struggled with as the nature of the church, the community which witnesses to the grace which brings new life into the midst of our sinful human condition. I believe this same pattern, going clear back to the worship pattern which shows itself in the Psalms, is also reflected in our own worship. In the great classical tradition of worship, there are three main acts of the worship drama. There are other liturgical sub-themes to the worship drama, but in confession, we confess our inadequacy before God, our need for the word of grace, the brokenness of our own sinful condition, the distresses from which we are incapable of delivering ourselves. In the service of the word, as we hear the scripture read, as we say that the creeds which witness to us from the historic tradition, as we hear the word proclaimed in the preached word, as we see it embodied in the sacrament as the word, then we receive that word of grace which speaks to the human condition which we have confessed before God. And then in the service of dedication or offering or commitment, whatever word we use to describe that third great act of the drama, we are called upon to respond in intercessory prayers and petitionary prayers and the giving of offerings and in being sent forth into the world to live as a changed and altered people, having heard the word which speaks to our condition. So that pattern is still present in our worship in a very significant way. Now, the Psalms, as a kind of a worship book left to us from Israel's worship experience, almost all of the Psalms in the Psalter can be described as illumining one of these three great areas of this pattern of faith and understanding. The Psalms of Lament are primarily keyed on the situations of distress. They begin from the situations of distress which both individuals and the corporate community bring before God. But we will see tomorrow when we study the Psalms of Lament that even as they focus on laying those situations of distress out before God, they are already confident of and pointing to that deliverance. There is only one psalm that I know in the entire Psalter that is an unrelieved psalm of lament, that has no pointing forward in confidence to that moment of deliverance. The Psalms of Thanksgiving look at the same experience back the other way. The Psalms of Thanksgiving give thanks for deliverance already experienced, and in doing so look back at the distress out of which one has been delivered. So the Psalms of Thanksgiving simply look at the same dynamic from the other end. The hymns of praise are related somewhat to the Psalms of Thanksgiving because they then give praise to the God who is manifested in this pattern of distress becoming deliverance. And so the hymns of praise, in a sense, sort of step back. Thanksgiving's witness to a specific situation of deliverance, and hymns of praise generalize that to give praise to God as the creator, or as the Lord of history, or as covenant partner of Israel. What they step back and give general praise to God in more celebrative terms, but also really are related to this experience of God which comes in the moment of deliverance. Then there's a whole host of psalms which witness the various elements of the community's response. There are festival psalms which come out of great festival occasions which reenact and celebrate some of the high moments of Israel's historic experience with these patterns. So we'll see festival psalms. There are kingship and enthronement psalms which relate to the king as the representative of God's ultimate kingship and celebrate that kingship of God and call the earthly king to faithfulness before God. They represent something of a distinct type that changes in his character after the kingship passes away. I'll say a word about that at another session. There are what we call prophetic psalms that point to that changed life, that changed way of acting that a delivered community must espouse. There are wisdom psalms that are, in effect, teaching psalms that reflect on that experience. The psalm we had last night in the readings for the Eucharist last night, Psalm 49, was a wisdom psalm and represented a teaching about wealth and poverty that has something to do with this changed way of acting that will be characteristic of the delivered community. So tomorrow we'll be looking at psalms of lament, the next day of psalms of thanksgiving and hymns of praise, and the third day at a variety of psalms that show the community responding in one way or another to that pattern of distress becoming deliverance. In the few minutes left to us today, I wanted us to look at Psalm 136, though, as a kind of psalm that gives a larger view of Israel's memory at work in the tradition. Almost all of the psalms speak of Israel's experience of God at some point in this pattern. And psalms like Psalm 136 are what we call salvation history psalms. In a sense, they tell the story of the whole pattern, especially of the first two parts of the pattern. They are, I had a professor once who called them memory psalms. They represent the distilled memory of the community of the whole pattern out of which its faith understanding grew.
The sense in which in these psalms, as well as all of the psalms, liturgy becomes shared history. And the worshiper, in using the psalms, is affirming that his experience is contemporary with that of Israel which went before him, and therefore the experience of Israel before him can apply to his situation in the present. With this kind of understanding, all of life becomes appropriate to lay before God. We'll see that the psalms have a rather unusual and forthright honesty about laying all of God's experience, all of experience before God. But this is a formal recalling of the historic experience of Israel. I choose this one to begin with because it's so easy to see the liturgical character of the Psalms by looking at Psalm 136, because every verse has the same response to it. It's fairly clear that this is a psalm in which probably the priest would give the line, the changing line, and the people would give the constant refrain of the response. Or perhaps there was a choir of temple singers that gave the response. We don't know exactly how it worked, but it's obvious that this psalm is shaped by liturgical usage. It is a psalm, although it's classed as a salvation history psalm, it is also a psalm of thanksgiving. And it begins with three verses of generalized summons to thanksgiving. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. And the response, for his steadfast love endures forever. Oh, give thanks to the God of gods. Oh, give thanks to the Lord of lords. Then verses 4 through 9 begin a segment of the psalm which points to God's work in creation. To him who alone does great wonders, to him who by understanding made the heavens, and the constant refrain, for his steadfast love endures forever. The word steadfast love there is the Hebrew word chesed, which is translated steadfast love, loving kindness, sometimes translated as mercy. It indicates God's covenant love. It's a covenantal word. It's a word that's always associated with God's faithfulness to the covenant relationship with Israel. That no matter what happens to Israel, God's steadfast love will endure forever. So, here first is a witness to God's work in creation. Then, starting with verse 10 over through verse 22, is a witness to God's work in Israel's own history. To him who smote the firstborn of Egypt and brought Israel out from among them, with a strong hand and an outstretched arm, who divided the Red Sea in sunder. This is, of course, the whole Exodus experience, and it goes on through the wilderness experience and brings them into the land. And verse 21 and 22, and gave their land as a heritage to Israel, his servant. And then in verses 23, 24, and 25, very interesting here, after reciting the great works of God as God has been known to Israel both in creation and in her own historic experience, the psalm says, it is he who remembered us in our low estate. And rest, I think these shouldn't be put in the past. The Hebrews, I think, here should be translated, it is he who remembers us in our low estate and rescues us from our foes, he who gives food to all flesh. So that the whole point of this psalm is that the same God who has been known in creation and history is the one who remembers us, who protects us from our foes, who gives us food. And then the psalm ends, oh, give thanks to the God of heaven, a final summons to thanksgiving. Now, there are a number of these salvation history psalms. all of which serve as formal ways of remembering the great event out of which the nature of God has come to be known to Israel. And by remembering those events, one is not just performing a historical exercise, one is saying that God still acts that way and can be counted on in the present. It is that same God who remembers us. Other salvation history psalms you might want to look at when you have time. Psalm 78 is an interesting one because it carries the historic memory on down to the kingship of David. Psalm 106 is another you might want to look at. We won't take time to look at those today. I want to leave some time now. Tomorrow we'll be looking at the laments, and I want to try to leave a bit of time each day for questions or comments. So I'll conclude my presentation for today and see if any of you have questions or comments or reflections.
You said something that hit home to me when you talked about their view of praise. Praise was appropriate at all times. Mm-hmm. And I didn't quite get why, how they looked at that. And could you expand on that a little bit more?
Well, I might ask you to hold that a bit because I want to, in connection with the hymns of praise, I want to explicate that whole concept of praise in great detail.
Okay.
So we'll be talking more on that, but let me just give a brief answer here and say that because praise was such a basic category for the Hebrews, they tended to define life as the ability to give praise. So that when they described biological death, there are some interesting psalms we'll be looking at, which say death is, and Sheol, which is the Hebrew underworld, death and Sheol are places where, which are terrible because it is no longer possible to praise God there. And therefore, not to be able to praise God while alive is to be as good as dead. It's very interesting how important the relationship between praise and life is. And the Hebrews had a concept of life and death that extended beyond the biological. We'll be talking about that in greater detail, too. Life and death were not just biological realities. They also said something about the quality with which one lived in the present. But not to be able to praise was to be already in the clutches of death. And praise, then, the ability to praise even in the moment of distress is a witness to confidence that God is present even in that moment, and that hope, new possibility, new life, all those ways of describing God's grace are present and possible even from that moment. Yeah, Larry?
Ruth, you made a point at the outset about the context of the psalm being Israel at worship and that it's corporate in character.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any evidence that the psalms were used devotionally by individuals? I mean, is it entirely a matter of the community at worship?
I don't think there's any evidence for that until a much later period after the closing of the canon. Now it would seem natural that if this was a part of the prayer and worship life of the corporate community, that one as an individual would draw strength from that. But the corporate understanding is so strong here, even in the individual psalms. There are psalms that speak out of individual situations. But it's very clear that those are individual situations brought forward for the support of the community. In other words, one never felt alone. One never felt even that it was a matter just between me and God.
Part of the way in which the reality of God in those situations was known was through the witness and support of the corporate community. So even the individual songs come out of the corporate worship life of Israel. I believe that's a pretty generally accepted understanding now among Old Testament scholars. This, by the way, was not the understanding until about the 1920s, when the work of a couple of important scholars kind of began to see the Psalms in a whole new light. And up until that point, the Psalms were almost totally dismissed theologically. They were seen to be important as kind of devotional materials, but they were not looked to for any really central theological understanding. So the change of that understanding of their setting changed the importance we attached to them theologically. Now I think you could hardly find in the view of Old Testament scholars, you could hardly find a more important book for understanding Israel's faith theologically. Yeah, Sue?
What's your feeling about the way we use Psalms so often adding on Trinitarian doxology to mainstream worship? Was there commonly a doxology of some kind put on the end of each Psalm in worship? Or?
Well, not in the Hebrew usage. I know it's hard for me to comment on that because I don't come from a tradition that does that. And so I'm not sure what the liturgical purpose for that has been historically. I don't have any problems with taking the Psalms and then using them in liturgical settings that also witness to our subsequent experience as a historic tradition of faith, because that would be very much in keeping with the character of the Psalms themselves. We in our liturgy should add the continued witness of our historic experience as a faith community. That should be somehow expressed and held forth in the liturgy side by side with the Psalms, which are a witness to an even older portion of that historic tradition. Yeah.
Is the music completely lost, but the music might have sounded like?
Yes. There's a standing joke among graduate students in Old Testament studies. You know, when you want to kid your colleague that he's about to wash out of the whole program, you say, "I hear they're going to assign you a dissertation topic on the tunes of the song." That's a synonym for an impossible task. There are certainly, of course, even though the original tunes are lost, one of the things that it would be nice to do if we had a lot of time would be to sample some of the rich music tradition that the Psalms have inspired in all periods of the faith community's life, both Jewish and Christian. It's clear that the musical character of the Psalms has continued to find expression in new forms, even if the original form has been lost.
Yeah. I know that they use these salvation history songs during the Passover time. Do Jewish people currently add on to those songs to bring them up to date to make the salvation history continuing? Or?
Well, the liturgy of Passover and other great festival occasions would have additional material. And some of it would be hymn-like in much the way the Psalms are. Of course, the canon is fixed for Judaism as it is for Christians, so that you don't add to the Psalms themselves. They are fixed as a witness from the formative worshiping community of Israel. But the salvation history psalms are not only used at Passover, they're used at several of the great festival occasions. They might also be used at the festival of Booths, when the covenant is renewed in the fall, and other great high holy day festival occasions.
In the one which you chose, there are 10 to 12 verses of "Thank you, Lord, for killing all of my enemies," and there are a particular amount here and there. Mark Twain would have a field day with that. Would you care to share on that at all?
Well, Mark Twain did a pretty good job on it. In this particular psalm, the tradition of coming into the land has to do with the two great kings who came out to bar Israel's entry into the promised land, Sion and Og, who were both great kings of the Transjordanian kingdoms that were refusing to even allow the Israelites passage through. And I think these things have come to witness to God's implacable opposition to all of those who oppose his purposes in history. The danger of this is that it will become a kind of an exclusivism which says God is on our side but no one else's. And so these psalms have to be balanced against other psalms, other portions of the whole Old Testament witness that makes clear that even Israel can become the opponent of God's purposes in history and therefore suffer her judgment as greatly as the other nation. And that's why in some ways I'm kind of working toward this theologically as a kind of a thought in process. We have made Old Testament theology centered almost solely on the Exodus experience and the movement of this particular people to fulfillment in the land. I'm almost coming to the notion of seeing Old Testament theology as revolving around two focal points, one the Exodus experience and the other the exile experience. And the one is particularistic. It's the way we have experienced God in our particular history. The other is universal, which says that even we don't have special privilege before God. What it means to be chosen is to be chosen for special responsibility, and even we can suffer the experience of God's judgment when we oppose God's will in history. And out of that then comes, in the prophets of the exile, an understanding of God's purposes for universal salvation, which do not emerge out of the early material, which are more concerned with Israel's own interpreting Scripture. We cannot afford to interpret Scriptures in isolation from one another, but must interpret them against the witness of the whole canon. For Christians, I think ultimately that even means interpreting them against the witness of the whole canon, including the New Testament. So that the final word on God's universal purposes of salvation is not spoken for Christians until the New Testament.